Good morning, everyone. I'm Jill Campbell, ANZ's Head of Investor Relations. Thank you for joining us for ANZ's ESG Investor Roundtable, in which we'll be discussing our environmental sustainability strategy and updated approach to climate change. I'd like to acknowledge that we're dialing in today from the lands of the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation here in Melbourne. I also acknowledge the traditional owners of the various lands on which our listeners are joining from today. I pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. Earlier this morning, we lodged an investor pack with the ASX along with our Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, the TCFD. The investor pack includes presentation slides on our environmental sustainability strategy and what's new in our climate change commitment. In addition, we also published on ANZ's shareholder website the actual updated climate change commitment. And you should have received an email from us this morning with a link to all of those materials. So today we'll be referring to the investor pack, but we're not going to be taking you through it slide by slide, although the presenters will refer to some slides as points of reference throughout their remarks. The materials and presentation may contain forward-looking statements or opinions, and in that regard, I draw your attention to the disclaimer on page one of the slide deck. Presenting today is our CEO, Shayne Elliott, and our Group Executive Institutional, Mark Whelan. They'll speak for about 10 minutes, after which we'll go to Q&A. Thanks, and now I'll pass to Shayne.
Okay, thanks, Jill, and good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us at the round table. Today, I will be covering the significant opportunities we see arising from a decarbonising economy, why we think ANZ is well positioned to facilitate the transition, and how we're responding through a new environmental sustainability strategy. And then my colleague Mark will discuss the specific elements in our updated climate change commitment and the progress on our engagement with 100 of our largest emitting business customers. And as Jill said, hopefully we'll speak for no more than 10 minutes, leaving plenty of time for questions. Now, before I start, let me just mention the key points I really want you to take away today. First, we're in a really strong position with many natural advantages to support the transition. Second, we have the right strategy, the right customer relationships and the capabilities. Third, we will prioritise resources, including our balance sheet, to enable the changes required. And finally, we will back our customers who have the right plans and the right commitments in place. Now, at the results last month, I mentioned the super cycle, which is already underway, driven by the transition to net zero emissions. The world is transforming rapidly, and most importantly, through how energy is produced, distributed, and consumed. In order to decarbonise, a series of things are taking place, and you can see some of the areas where change is occurring on slide 7. For example, key sectors that can are decarbonising, such as vehicle fleets and manufacturing. At the same time, new sources of green electricity, battery options for storage, different distribution networks, and hydrogen solutions will need to be developed. There's also options like carbon capture use and storage, which have a role over the medium to long term to support those industries not easily decarbonised. And change is also being seen in financial markets and systems, driven by regulatory, customer and community expectations, and this is impacting how climate risk is assessed, managed, reported and priced. Trillions of dollars in investment is needed for the world to transition to net zero by 2050. And of course, banks have a key role and a significant opportunity in arranging, directing and distributing the finance required. And we're embracing this and believe we're well placed to shape and support that required, the required transition. Because, you know, we're Australia's only truly regional bank with a network connecting customers to low carbon opportunities across the global economy. We've got the right customers who are already embracing the transition, and we're a leader in banking resource and infrastructure projects. And finally, we are the dominant trade bank and number one in debt capital markets and syndicated loans, both critical ingredients for success. And look, we're not starting from zero, we're already making progress. For example, in the area of sustainable finance, we estimate we have a share of around 5% of global flows. And during 2021, this business participated in 81 transactions with total deal size of $119 billion. And our direct lending to renewables is now $1.4 billion, which has significantly increased over the last few years. We've also helped finance around 1,000 small and medium enterprises to reduce their emissions, and that's worth about $225 million through the ANZ CEFC program, which helps business customers invest in energy-efficient assets such as electric transport or machinery. Now, with these opportunities in mind, we've also looked to our broader strategy and what capabilities are required to participate even more so. Our environmental sustainability strategy on slide 9 outlines the areas that where we will direct our finance, services and advice to support customers in shifting to low carbon business models. And to deliver the strategy, we're also investing in our business and our people. And on slide 11, you can see some of that. And that talks to deepening our understanding of the transition for our people, customers and the community, building out our climate risk expertise, having better data and technology to develop insights and track emissions, strengthening our industry and product knowledge, and underpinning this will be the development of our people, ensuring that we have the right culture and mindset focused on environmental sustainability. Now lastly, I just want to mention that ANZ recently committed to the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which is about broadening, deepening and accelerating the transition. Of course, signing up is easy, but we will be measured by our actions. In summary, it's about providing more finance to support our customers to achieve less emissions. Now, to quote Mark Carney from the Net Zero Banking Alliance for a moment, we must go where the emissions are. And the transition itself needs to be financed. So our approach is about backing our customers and assisting them with their transitions. That is what will make the difference. So in closing, let me say we are at an exciting pivot point. Rightly, we have focused on climate risk and what we won't do. And now we're moving firmly to utilise our vast resources, financial, risk appetite, customer relationships and structural know-how to make a positive impact to achieving net zero emissions and a sustainable future. So with that, I'll hand over to Mark.
Good. Thanks, thanks, Shane, and hello, everyone. Today, I'm going to talk through the policy changes in our climate change commitment and also how we're continuing to engage with our largest emitting business customers, or effectively our top 100. Now, I'll talk for about 5 minutes and then we'll open for questions. Now, our climate change commitment sets out what we will do and how we'll support our customers through the transition. There are four key areas where we'll focus, and you can see them outlined on slide 15 of the pack that you've received. Now, they are supporting our customers and industries to transition, aligning our lending decisions to the Paris Agreement goals, reducing emissions from our own operations, and finally, engaging constructively and transparently with all stakeholders. Now, to provide some context, I'll highlight some key points from each area. First, supporting our customers and industries to transition. The most important role we can play is to help our customers reduce their own emissions and shift to low carbon operations. And we'll do this by directing our finance into key priority areas and sectors of opportunity. An example of this, which Shane just mentioned, is carbon capture storage, hydrogen, solar, wind, and sectors like technology and resources, including rare earths. We've also committed to allocating $50 billion by 2025 towards sustainable finance options or opportunities in bonds, loans and green trade. And this year we hit almost $22 billion towards that target. Now, to facilitate this, we are equipping our employees with a deep understanding of climate risks and opportunities through formal training and capability build. This expertise will help us to develop products and services in areas including green and sustainability-linked bonds, loans, and carbon trading as just some examples. We'll also provide lending and advisory services to help customers buy, sell, and raise capital for renewable energy. And finally, project finance to support long-term sustainable infrastructure. Secondly, we are committing to aligning our lending decisions to the Paris goals to finance significant emissions reductions. We have already seen a rapid reduction in the emissions intensity of the electricity generation assets we directly finance. This is down by more than 30% since 2020, the lowest level in 8 years and well below Australia's grid average. In addition, today we've announced intensity reduction pathways in our portfolio for two key sectors, large-scale commercial buildings and power generation. For our large-scale commercial buildings portfolio in Australia, we've set a new target to achieve a 60% emissions intensity reduction by 2030. The non-residential building sector is one of the largest final end users of electricity and so will play a critical role in meeting carbon reductions over the next decade. We are already seeing strong progress with many of our customers who are proactively positioning their properties to reduce emissions intensity. And as a result, the emissions intensity of our office buildings portfolio has reduced by around one quarter already since 2019. For our power generation portfolio, we've set a new target to achieve a 50% emission intensity reduction by 2030. This is important because electricity generation accounts for around one-third of Australia's national emissions. Now, to help explain this, we've included some examples in the slide pack on page 22. These are the types of targets our customers have set as they move along the pathway and potential investment decisions we would support. For example, in commercial property, likely investment decisions include electric plants and equipment, on-site renewable energy and battery storage in buildings. In power generation, it's supporting customers who are transforming their fleets to low or zero carbon technologies. This includes investments and increased deployment of large-scale renewables and enabling technologies. In addition to the targets, our commitment also sets out that we will back new energy customers with Paris-aligned business plans and also back existing energy customers who have public diversification plans and strategies and are measuring and disclosing progress in reducing emissions from their value chain. These new measures, along with our target pathways, have been developed with our customers front of mind. We are committed to supporting customers in transition with Paris-aligned strategies. This means we'll only fund oil and gas projects, as an example, if they meet the expectations I've just referred to. We would work with our customers to better understand their plans and, where needed, help with next steps and ensure alignment with our portfolio aspirations and our policies. For existing customers, we are allowing time to develop those plans and engagement is well underway. Finally, it's about engaging with our stakeholders constructively and transparently. We are working with all stakeholders, and this includes our customers, government, regulators, shareholders, civil society, and industry associations, and importantly, regional communities. Within this, the work we do with our 100 of our top emitting and institutional customers is critical. These customers have facilities and are generally medium in term in nature, so around the 3 to 5 years in length. This gives us time to engage regularly on their transition plans and discuss how we can fund their emissions reductions over time. We've now engaged with all 100 customers, and outside of them, many others have also approached us directly for advice. Through our structured engagement, we consider three key elements that can constitute a robust, low-carbon transition plan: governance, targets, and disclosures that are preferably TCFD aligned. Very good progress is being made, and we continue to see plans advancing at pace with our customers. With that in mind, let me hand back to the operator for questions. Thank you.
Thank you. If you wish to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone and wait for your name to be announced. If you wish to cancel your request, please press *2. If you're on a speakerphone, please pick up the handset to ask your question. Your first question comes from Brian Johnson from Jefferies. Please go ahead.
Good morning and thank you very much for the presentation. Two questions from me. First one, Mark, and I've asked about this before, how do you treat derivative exposures that result in carbon emission here? So, for example, a take-or-pay contract on a railway line that basically services the coal industry. Where do derivatives fit within this, and are you specifically measuring the carbon intensity of that?
We are, Brian, and it's in exact science as you would expect, but with regards to the derivatives within the customer's portfolios, we work with the customers to try and determine that in the first instance. And obviously any business that we do with the customers, whether it's direct financing or whether it's supply of actually derivative contracts, we are also measuring the carbon intensity of that. This is, as I think Shane mentioned earlier, the data associated with this is really quite critical, and we see it improving not only in our customers' disclosures and information that they provide to us, but also internally with our own portfolios and the measurement of the carbon intensity of the products that we provide. So it's a combination of both.
So the carbon emission data that we can see being disclosed, Mark, that includes the derivatives book or it doesn't?
Yeah.
It does. Yes, it does.
It does? Great. The second one, Mark, there's been a lot of talk about the quality of Australian carbon offsets. Can you just provide some comfort about the quality of them and the pricing of them going forward? Do they just come from Australia or are they coming globally? Could you run us through that, please?
Oh, I think the carbon offsets, it's a global market. I think with regards to what we've seen in the market more recently, I think the customers that we deal with are actively looking at the quality of those carbon offsets, where they're being produced, and how they're refining their approach to that would be a fair comment, I think, on that. Brian, I think that it's been more global in nature recently, and they're now moving, many of our customers, including ourselves, obviously, are now moving in line with the Australian government standards. And I think you'll see that continue. So it's improving. I think it may have been not as clean as we would have liked, I think, in the past, but I think it's moving in the right direction now, and as particularly as it's getting aligned to more of the government standards.
Just a final one for Shane, if I may. Shane, great presentation today. A lot of material. Take a while, obviously, to go through it. But I'm just intrigued. Last time that we did an ESG briefing, we spent a lot of time talking about housing affordability. There's nothing in this ESG pack even that I can see on that. Can you just update us on your thoughts on that?
Sure, and the reason there's not
the other ESG issues?
Yeah, no, fair enough. I mean, today was obviously very targeted around climate change, and so that's what we focused the presentation on.
Yeah.
I don't know that there's a huge amount to update. At the last presentation, we talked about our concerns around affordability. If anything, they've got that those stresses have become worse as we've seen house prices continue to accelerate, and that has very real implications for the way we run our business, the way we think about risk appetite, and others. And in fact, just this week at our board meeting, we had a broader conversation, and we're going to plan some more in-depth discussion around the longer term social impacts of that and what that could mean for our business. We're going to seek to do that early in the new year, Brian. The only thing I would say on the ESG front is, and more broadly, the areas that we're really trying to turn our mind to there, I think we well understand the existing issues, and I'm not diminishing, and we're certainly not done on those. And climate change is a good example, but we're turning our minds to better understanding some of the more emerging issues, for example, biodiversity, which is, you know, related to climate, but in and of itself, we see that becoming an increasing issue, and we need to be prepared for that, and that at this stage is more about education and understanding.
So that one's still being scoped out. That was the fourth question. Thank you very much, Shane. Appreciate it. Thanks, mate. Well done.
All right, thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Rob Coe from Morgan Stanley. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you very much for the presentation. As a former ANZ alumni, it makes me feel quite good. So my first question just relates to risk appetite, because you've obviously talked up the massive opportunity. Can you talk to whether you're looking to increase your risk appetite into things like trading and development, or is your kind of core business, you know, funding, project finance, all that good stuff, you know, basically where you're staying?
Yeah, thanks, Robert. It's a good question. Look, we've done about, I think, last 16, 18 weeks, we've done a really deep dive into where we see the best opportunities in the whole climate area and sustainability area. And we identified 6 major areas and about 11 initiatives of where we would like to grow our capability and build our product capabilities, if you like. And certainly some of those areas would be obvious, like hydrogen, looking at, you know, resource extraction, you know, where we want to go and support the electrification of transportation. But it also does include where we would see opportunities on carbon trading, carbon capture, sourcing carbon offsets, etc. So we're doing a bit of work with regards to that at this point in time. We've already got a small operation in that space, but we're looking to resource that up as well as in these, some of these other areas that I just mentioned. There's about 11 specific initiatives. Part of it, you know, some of it's in advisory, part of it's in certain sectors. But in the trading, in a trading sense, we see there's really large opportunities to participate in what's going to become a bigger market in that carbon trading and carbon offsets.
I mean, the way I think about it, Rob, is, you know, we would probably do very, if we didn't change anything in terms of our product capability, and, you know, we had some learnings around, you know, learn a little bit more about hydrogen and lithium, et cetera, we would probably do very, very well, but that would be insufficient for us to be able to truly support our customers, and that in order to be, to really maximise the opportunity and truly be of help to customers through the transition, we need to keep doing what we do well, and we need to augment that both in terms of knowledge and capability. And your, to your point, that will mean a shift in risk appetite. And so we'll need, and you know, we're at the early stages of that, but over time, yes, because we're going to have to learn new skills. It will open up, as Mark just mentioned, some new opportunities, and that by definition will have implications for our risk appetite.
So when we did, just to finish that one off, Rob, when we looked at these different initiatives and we built them, that was with a combination of our subject matter experts internally, product people, relationship managers, but importantly our credit team as well, so that we, as we work through how we would approach each of these markets, it's being done in conjunction with risk, so it's not going to be just presented at the end. They're actually formulating our policies as we develop our strategies to execute.
Okay, great, thank you. My next question, I guess, is in relation to your new intensity targets, and which are, you know, on the face, you know, align with the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which is it seems to be the standard that people are coming to. Can I? I guess this is more of a fine print type question, but are these targets kind of at all times targets, or are they point in time? And I guess the implication of that subtlety is it has implications for how much you can underwrite, you know, between balance dates, if that makes sense.
I think I understand your question. Do you want to, Jared, how do you, I'm just looking to one of our colleagues here who...
Hey, Rob, it's Jared.
Yeah.
How about we take it offline, Rob, and I can speak to you directly about it.
I think I understand what you're saying, but I mean, when I guess the glib answer, we're not trying to be cute here and say we'll run it up during the year and manage it down towards the end of reporting dates. That's not the intention, clearly. But like all these things, neither will these things always be day-to-day a straight line in one direction, yeah. Right? So there's a little bit of tolerance in there, but again, we're not looking to be cute about the measurement.
I'd probably just add, I mean, the trajectory that we've sort of modelled that we need to be on, and our starting points today and where we want to participate and support our customers in transition will naturally lead to, on occasions, underwriting transactions and then sell down of those transactions to ensure that the positions are in line with that policy and the trajectory that we need to get to 2030, et cetera. So it won't be a straight line in a lot of instances. There may be blips, but ultimately we're still heading to those same targets that we have, that we've put in the packs that you've received.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. It's a marathon, not a sprint. I get it. And Jared, look forward to catching up again, mate. So my last question, if you'll indulge me one more, is I guess I mean, you always have to think about the downsides too. I think that that nice Irish gentleman mentioned, you were doing a lot of work on climate adaptation as well as all of this mitigation work. Can you maybe update us on where you're at with, say, sea level rise sensitivities and things like that?
Maybe that's for you, Kevin.
By chance, our Irish gentleman is in the
room. I think it was the other Irish. I think it might have been the chairman.
Oh, dear. Yeah. No, you're the one that I meant, Kevin.
Oh, okay, Rob. Well, look, thank you. I think, you know, we're doing quite a bit of work, and I think we set it out in the disclosures as well. One of the things we spent the last 7 years on is working closely with the Australian Bureau of Meteorology, looking at rainfall patterns across the country, and from that we're able to plot sort of areas where there have been significant deficiencies in rainfall. We then have discussions with our customers to understand, you know, what that means for them in terms of, you know, what they plan on doing. And that is, to be honest, that has been incredibly well received by those customers. We would look to then extend that analysis that we've done into the sort of things that you've referred to, such as rising sea levels, but it's not to date, you know, something that we have actually done a whole amount of analysis on. And what we'll obviously look to do is make sure that what we're doing there is aligned with TCFD requirements as well.
Yep. Rob, there's an update on our work on page 7 of the TCFD, which you'll have in front of you.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Jen. So much obliged.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Richard Mania from North Cape Capital. Please go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. Mark, you mentioned your approach to financing the oil and gas industry. Do you mind just elaborating on that a little bit more, like especially when it comes to new projects in that space? How do you decide whether to support them or not?
Yeah, I think it really gets down to the customer and the customer that we're dealing with, and you know, it's just starting with the existing customers. Many of them, as you would have guessed, sit in that top 100. So we've been having ongoing discussions with them for long periods of time around what they're doing with regards to their own transition and how they're achieving it. And as you're aware, a number of them are diversifying their business, or they're investing in assets that will lower carbon intensity over and above what they have today. So we seek to, first of all, understand what they're doing and then look at how that plays out into the policies that we are putting in place with regards to our total portfolio, if you like, and how it fits into that. So we will then address the individual transactions with these individual customers, and then, as I said, see how that plays out into our portfolio. So it's ongoing discussion. So in some instances we've said yes to transactions, in other instances, you know, we've said no. And it has to be based on our understanding of their own transition and what they're doing with governance, with disclosures, and the way that they're managing their own facilities. So, and what we've seen is that the conversations are actually being quite fruitful. We've had a number of discussions between our finance teams and ESG teams here with their own finance teams and ESGs with the oil and gas companies, and there's surprising a lot more alignment than maybe I would have thought was there when we initially started this process. So it's an ongoing thing. It means that we seek to understand where they're at and where they're going and how that fits into their portfolio and then how it fits into ours, and then we make decisions from there. So there's no surprises from either end. With regards to new customers, we haven't ruled them out, but we've set the bar significantly higher. And if we see new customers that are really aggressive in going into particularly managing reductions in emissions in this space, then we will consider them. I think they'll be exceptions rather than rules because of the level of hurdle rate that we're putting in with regards to them. So we feel that that's an appropriate, pragmatic way to support transition to the outcomes that we all seek by 2050.
Okay, and then when you're looking at the customers' transition plans, are you mainly focused on their own emissions, like scope 1 and 2, or are you also thinking about scope 3 emissions there?
We're following the customers, but it's basically 1, 2 and 3. And you'll find that many of them now, because, I mean, the shift, I think, in the last 18 months particularly has been quite strong around the oil and gas companies. You're seeing it in the Europeans particularly, and you're seeing it here in Australia as well, where they're now engaging in not only one and two, but also three. And therefore, you know, we find that very encouraging, and therefore we're supporting more of that through these 100 and meter sort of engagements that we're having. So it is three, and I think you'll find, because a lot of the investors that are in the bank, and we take obviously counsel from them, but also they're the same investors that are in these large oil and gas companies. So the message has been strong right across the board, and I think people are reacting positively to that. So I think it's quite a good direction that we're heading.
Okay. So it sounds like you're not actually ruling out supporting new projects there, provided there's some sort of overall strategy from the customer to transition by 2050.
Yeah, their starting point would have to be significantly better than the existing customers. And our benchmarks for them will be really high. So as I said, you know, we don't rule it out because we think that's probably in the best interest of getting to a better outcome to 2050, as I said. But that benchmark is really high, so it'll be exceptions, not the rule.
Okay.
To new customers.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Lou Caparelli from UniSuper. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity. My question is a bit of a variation on the last one, and obviously topical in the context of the Woodside Scarborough announcement this week. But I'm just wondering about, rather than focusing on new energy customers, what about new energy projects from either new or existing customers? And I'm just curious if you've got any, if you've done any thinking around those issues.
Yeah, well,
particularly in light of the,
Talk about a specific customer, but...
I'm not asking you to.
No, that's right. But in Prince in general, I just wanted to make that sort of clear up front. But Lou, it's a good question, but it's a similar approach that we're taking with new. You know, if we think that through, and you're going to see, our view is you'll see a lot more M&A activity in this space because the bigger customers will either divest their assets or they'll actually acquire more assets which they can run more efficiently to drive down their own emissions. We think that the intention, if we believe the intention and the outcome of what they're doing is aligned with reduction in emissions, then we would consider it. That's the approach that we've taken, and that's the discussions that we've had with all of the customers. So they've got to really fit those two criteria for us, and then we would entertain it, because we feel pragmatically if we are serious about getting to, you know, the 2030 and 2050 targets that that are Paris aligned, then customers that have the financial capability and intention to drive to that, we'd rather be supporting them than not supporting them.
Yeah, and I think just to add to that, it's not, and I don't want people to walk away thinking, oh, we somehow assess a customer and give them a gold star and therefore say it's a free-for-all for that customer, we can just, you know, no. Obviously, even with a customer that does have a Paris-aligned strategy, every marginal lend we do with that customer will still be subject to the same level of scrutiny to say, is this further enhancing the ability towards lower emissions? Whether that's true because they've acquired a new asset or whether they're developing a new one, et cetera, we would go through at that level of scrutiny.
And can I just ask, in terms of the scrutiny you apply, companies might make claims about how low carbon the project is or some sort of general and typically vague and difficult to, measure statement around, by us providing this project, we are displacing this many tonnes of thermal coal generation elsewhere. I mean, what's the sort of, filters and inputs you look at to make that determination in your scrutiny? And forgive the sort of, what's the word?
No, it's fair.
The weed nature of the question.
No, I think it's a totally fair question.
We start with looking at what their public disclosures are, and then the actions against those public disclosures, and how they are progressing in execution to that. And so that's the primary thing that we would look at. And remembering, these are major, we're talking about major customers here who are managing their own brand and reputation in this space and are under the same pressures that we're seeing right across the board. So we certainly ask the questions. We review it against their public disclosures, and most of them, as you're aware, are TCFD aligned. And then we make a judgment against that. Remembering too that if we've made a commitment to them and they've made their commitments, we don't just do that and then walk away. You know, we're in constant conversations with these customers, and this transition will take some time. So we meet with them regularly to ensure that they're meeting their obligations that they've said publicly, and so that we understand where they are in their own trajectory. So that's the way that we're approaching it.
And I think to your question, your broader question, obviously in that assessment there is a judgmental factor around credibility. So I understand that, and that's why those discussions with the top 100 emitters are at the most senior levels, including, I haven't done all 100 of them, but including myself and Mark. And part of that is to actually assess, do we really believe that the senior management, including CEOs, the CFOs, their board members if necessary, actually get this and actually truly are committed to this, and it's not just some, PR exercise.
Yeah, and Shane and I have undertaken a number of images even in recent weeks and meeting with CEOs and CFOs of these companies just to ensure that, we're getting comfortable with what they're saying is actually being acted upon.
And like anything, Lou, like anything in banking, track record speaks a lot, right, and character. And so, of course, past performance and their past credibility in terms of meeting their commitments to us in whatever field that might be, by the way, not just in climate, is an essential part of our banking, assessing character and their ability to actually meet and do what they say they're going to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Stuart Palmer from Australian Ethical Investment. Please go ahead.
Yes, thank you. And sorry, I'm going to just a couple of questions, but the first one is to continue that oil and gas theme and circumstances, or how you think about new exploration and extraction projects. And I guess how you would be expecting your customers to think about the new IEA scenario, Net Zero by 2050, which came out earlier this year, which from their perspective sort of provided some clarity around, what is and isn't Paris aligned in terms of new oil and gas exploration and extraction, and saying no exploration and new extraction projects if they're already on the books and approved, but otherwise no. In line with, I guess, the clarity we've seen develop around new thermal coal projects, how are you thinking about any new oil exploration or extraction projects given the IEA's scenario?
I think, again, with regards to it, Stuart, we don't rule out anything. We sit and look and talk to our customers and assess how and what they're looking to do will impact their publicly disclosed TCFD and PACTA arrangements. And if we're comfortable that it may fit that, we'll entertain it. Doesn't say that we'll necessarily do it. It means that we'll entertain it. And then we'll also overlay that commitment, if we were to do it, against what our own portfolio looks like at that point and where we want to be over 2030 and 2050. And the two have to align before we would entertain it. And then it gets down to, whether we feel it's an appropriate transaction to undertake for the bank. So I'm not saying that we would do it necessarily, but what we would do is not just discard it immediately, because we feel that may be counterproductive to a better outcome overall. So usually these decisions will come through to myself, to Kevin, and to Shane and Jared, who looks at where we're at with regards to our trajectories, and we would have a four-way conversation about whether we feel it's appropriate or not. And I'd have to say, though, that anything new gets a greater degree of scrutiny than the existing that we have, and existing transactions and developments that are in with our customers. So it gets a higher bar, if I can put it that way.
Okay, thanks. In terms of then the sort of looking across the portfolio, you've got the generation target. Have you looked at targets you might put in place for that oil and gas project, oil and gas company exposure, reducing that over time?
Yes, I think that's a really fair question.
Yep.
Yes, and I think we've said it. I know we've said it in here. We've started with two sectors. Two pretty important ones, by the way, in terms of emissions, and we need to add to that, and we hope we will be adding to those and disclosing those in 2022. You might ask, well, why do we wait? A lot of it's to do with just data and making sure we can do these things robustly and properly. And so we've started with two significant areas, power generation and large-scale commercial, and they're areas where not only is the impact material, but also our ability to measure and actually be accurate in this is pretty high. But yes, you're right. We should expect oil and gas to be a fast follower.
Okay. And are you thinking differently at all about conventional gas against unconventional gas projects and new sort of unconventional shale gas projects, for example, in the Northern Territory?
Yes, I mean, they're held to the same standard, if that makes sense. So, you know, whether they're conventional or not, the standards are the same. And whether that's the standards about the sponsors or the project or the emissions, et cetera, essentially there's no real difference of lens. The outcomes may be different. There might be maybe different paths to get to the right outcomes, but it's the same standard for all.
Okay, thanks. And one more, if I can, just jumping to...
Yeah.
Some of the material around biodiversity and and the engagement with Coles was interesting. I haven't absorbed it all in detail, but just interested to hear the extent to which deforestation issues are sort of on the radar when you're looking at food and agriculture and supermarkets. Concerns raised by a range of local and international bodies about ongoing deforestation associated with beef production and so on.
Yeah, no, absolutely, it's on the radar. I mean, it's not, and I don't want people to, it's always been on the radar. I think it's just become a bigger issue, and it's a bit like the sort of scope 1, 2, and 3 version of climate change. It's similar here. So we've always had land use policies and been really sensitive, particularly about deforestation and even biodiversity to that matter. I think what we're learning is that we can take a lot of the things we've learned and applied and frameworks and thinking around taking from the sort of purer climate area and actually apply them similarly into areas like deforestation. So yes, it is becoming a larger item of discussion at our board ethics and ESG committee, and also in our ethics and responsible banking committee, which is our sort of operative committee that I lead, in terms of that sets up our policies and approaches to those. So yes, it's an increasing issue.
Okay, thanks very much.
It's a bit, it's interesting because it's probably, I don't know, you guys probably know better than me. It's just a few years behind in terms of where the development and thinking and the measurement and how would you measure and all that other stuff. What's good about that is actually there's some alignment here because we're also doing a lot of work around just general supply chain thinking, whether it's to do with human rights, for example, as well, and really sort of broadening and understanding our impact and our influence, not just in terms of our direct operations, but through our customers and suppliers and all of those. So there's general alignment here about broadening our thinking about our impact, and biodiversity, including deforestation and land use, are clearly, again, sort of fast followers, I think, into this area.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I guess, yeah, the final comment I'd make is, when we're looking at some of these areas where it seems we're getting increasing clarity that we just really shouldn't be clearing any more land for agriculture, for beef production, you know, we shouldn't be funding new oil and gas projects. Always keen to hear from banks who are involved in funding those activities, what they think about that, whether you're seeing the world differently in terms of what is and isn't consistent with Paris.
Look, the short answer to that, high level, yes, we are giving much more thought to that. I think, you know, that's been a maturity of the industry, which is to be more thoughtful, to be more conscious of the multiple stakeholders that we deal with, to be more thoughtful about the broader community expectations about our role and the impact that we have when we make decisions about who we bank and how we operate. So yes, and that's a good thing. Now, it's complex, and I think what we're trying to position here, and I understand some of this comes with trust, and that's always difficult because we have to earn that, is that, yes, it would be nice just to have a whole bunch of black and white rules. We will do this, we won't do that, but life is more complicated than that, and there are different stakeholders, and so, again, we're not shying away from having better rules and better guidelines and stronger principles, but also accepting that we need to make difficult, complex trade-off decisions, and we do that by making sure, at the heart of it, in our view, the most important thing, it goes back to customer selection. Are we dealing with customers who have an aligned view around purpose and impact, and actually have the wherewithal and the ability to act responsibly in whichever area that is? In this case today, we're talking about emissions, but, you know, to your point, it could well be in other areas. And that's the most fundamental protection that we have as a bank, but also how we have the greatest impact in terms of the impact on the broader community.
Right. Thank you.
And it's sort of just about, and that's why we've set up. I mean, it's interesting, and again, it may not be apparent, but, you know, well, what is it? I don't know. Jared might remember, four or five years ago, we didn't have an ESG committee of the board. You know, we didn't have an ethics and responsible banking committee at the executive, and now they are extremely active and broad committees in terms of their impact on the organisation and making real decisions about who we bank, how we behave, what are the issues that we lean into, et cetera. And so they're having, and, you know, so there's been a significant maturity around it, but, you know, still got a long way to go.
Yeah.
We understand that.
And I think, you know, Stuart, the other example I gave earlier about as we see transactions come to us from our customers, the amount of debate and scrutiny that we put on that internally now has gone to a whole new level. Because we want to ensure that we are supporting lower emissions. That may mean increased financing, but it's got to be against lower emissions outcomes. And that's the way we're trying to position for this. And so that gets significantly more scrutiny than it ever has. And I think it will probably continue to get more scrutinised internally.
Right. Thanks. That's not good. Definitely good to hear.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Sue Lynn Stubbs from Macquarie. Please go ahead.
Great. Good morning, and thank you for your time. Just sort of a following question from financing energy customers. I see on slide 16 that you're seeking Paris-aligned business plans for existing customers by 2025. And my first question really is, how are you engaging with those existing customers in the interim while their plans aren't Paris-aligned? And then also, what is your approach for projects or customers if they end up not being Paris-aligned by 2025? What are your decision-making and what are your plans for those projects?
The conversations are still ongoing. And so we're working with these top 100 emitters around, and many of them, as you'll see, I think there's some other slides in the pack that show where we're at with regards to our engagement with these customers, and we seek first of all to understand where they're at, whether they're just starting out in this process or whether they're progressing quite strongly with regards to their Paris alignment and their disclosures and what their actions are. And ultimately, we work through that with them. So we're looking for specific time-bound transition plans and diversification strategies by 2025. And, you know, those discussions are well advanced with all of the 100 emitters. And they're within those 100 emitters, there are various stages and how they would meet to that. If they were in a situation by 2025 where they hadn't done this, then we would be having, decisions to be made based on, you know, our expectations. And we're better off flagging our position and working with these customers early, just as we did when we came to thermal coal, and where our expectations are in managing our business on behalf of our shareholders and getting that aligned with our customers where we practically can. If we don't get to a point where there is an impasse, then we obviously have to make some decisions around that. And we've done that in the past. We'd continue to do it going forward.
The only thing I would add to that would be that in the meantime, it's not a free pass. So in the meantime, if they don't, we still apply the same standards. And if one of those customers came to us for a new lend or a new project or whatever, we would still apply exactly the same process we just talked about. So it's not you get a free pass until 2025. We will still be applying the same standards as I mentioned.
Great, thank you. And just switching track a little bit around your scenario analysis, and I'm sure there will be more when the CVA comes out, but I just wanted to understand, aside from the pilot analysis that you've done in your agricultural portfolio and resources portfolio in 2019, have there been any other developments? What other disclosure can you provide?
Well, there's an update on our risk analysis in relation to those portfolios at page 7 of the TCFD. And as you pointed out yourself, as the CVA unfolds over the coming year, there'll obviously be further disclosures as well.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Alison Ewings from Regnan. Please go ahead.
Thanks. It was interesting to hear your comments on some of the hardest field bait sectors and good to hear that you're taking on some of those challenges. I wondered if you could elaborate on the work underway or planned, particularly for sustainable food and beverage and commodities, as called out on slide 9, perhaps in more general terms and some of the specific items in the Coles example.
Yeah, just bear with us, just looking at the slide, make sure we're on the same page. Yeah, so I think, I'll start and I'll get Mark to talk or Kevin to talk to. So if we sort of stand back and think about the broader objectives here, what we've really tried to do is say, clearly we are trying to have a positive impact, yeah? And if we want to have a positive impact, we sort of have to go where the emissions are, to use that Mark Carney piece. And so what we've done here is identified where we think that where the emissions are and where there is the opportunity, clearly, given our customer base as ANZ and given our capabilities to have influence over the outcome. And when we go through that, as you quite rightly point out, one of the larger areas is in the food, beverage and agricultural or commodity sector. Again, we're talking, and just to be really clear here, in general, we're talking about at the top end of town here. We're not talking about family farmers or the like at this stage. We're talking about the larger multinational food companies and the impact that they have through their program. And clearly a lot of that is to do with, in many ways it's more complicated than energy because of the complex supply chains that they have.
Yeah.
So we're learning more about that. I will say at ANZ, just to give you some dimension, that's not, from an exposure point of view, it's not as large because, hopefully for obvious reasons, but so we don't quite have the same financial clout, if you will, or exposure in that sector. But Mark, do you want to talk through where we are? Because obviously it's more complex as well in terms of some of the data availability.
Yeah. So again, it gets down to, Alison, just working. There's a number of customers, don't know the exact number, that sort of fit this food, beverage, commodities area that sit in the top 100. We feel it's really important to start with those because they are the largest emitters. We're finding in the conversations that we're having with them, many of them are actually quite progressed in the way that they are managing their own supply chains and practices. And in some instances, we've actually done some green trade and supply chain transactions, but it's really in its infancy is the way I would probably talk to that. There is pretty strong commitment from the ones that we've spoken to, but it's less developed than what I would have seen in some of the other industries, it's fair to say. And as Shane mentioned, the data associated with this sometimes because of the supply chain issues is less robust, but it doesn't mean that we're not looking quite closely at that and working closely with these customers.
Yeah, and lots of complexity with where the emissions come from, whether that's growing or food waste or what have you.
Yeah.
So it's difficult to track. Actually, related to that, I wondered if you, and apologies if this isn't buried in the pack, but do you have a sense of what proportion of your financed emissions are actually covered by that top 100?
It's a good question.
I think that's actually indicated at the table, actually. I just don't have it immediately in front of me, but I think it's actually noted there.
Is it about 20% to 30% or something? I can't remember.
30%.
30%. Yeah, I think it's about 30%, Alison. So it's substantial.
And I did just have a quick question on the biodiversity piece as well. I noticed both in the pack today and in the ESG briefing earlier in the year, a lot of the framing was very much around the impacts of companies on biodiversity. But I was also interested in what extent you're also considering the impacts of biodiversity loss on clients and their profitability.
Yeah, we started to think about that. We're looking to take a similar approach in what we're doing with the connected, as Shane mentioned earlier, on climate. So the discussions have started to pick up, and we will look to that in more detail with the other work that we're currently undertaking around, for 2022, but how we would apply similar principles into this space with our customers, because it's certainly getting, I'm sure you know, Alison, probably better than I, the amount of focus that's getting, particularly in the offshore markets, I think is now starting to move here, and we think it's a serious issue that we need to look to address. So our work around what we've done with the top 100, the way that we approach the way we're having conversations, understanding their approach to it, will be applied similarly on the biodiversity issues.
Thanks.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Amy Krasanovic from Aware Super. Please go ahead.
Thank you, and thanks for the presentation, and good to see the updated climate change commitments, particularly for the energy sector. My question relates to that. One of your peers, as I'm sure you've seen, has capped oil and gas exposure at default and also looking to reduce exposure aligned to the IEA net zero 2050 scenario. Just interested in your views on a cap and whether it was considered as part of the updated commitments, or will this be looked at as part of the 2022 update that you referenced earlier?
Yeah, of course. Yes, we did look at it, and without... Well, I can't avoid it, really. I think, caps are simple, right? And they have there's some attraction to that. But again, these are complex issues. And again, if we go back and say, what are we trying to achieve here? Are we just trying to look good, or are we actually trying to have an impact? And if we're really trying to have an impact on lower emissions, our view is we should give more finance to those companies that are actually driving lower global emissions for, the planet, so not just moving them around. And so we think that putting a simple cap in place could actually end up achieving the wrong outcome, which means that we're not actually able to provide finance to those that are doing the right thing. So, again, we're not, and I understand the sort of subtlety of that, and it can look like we're trying to avoid having limits. That's not our intention. But again, we think there will be potentially opportunities to do the right thing by increasing exposure to the sector in limited circumstances where the net outcome is actually a net positive for emissions. And I don't think we should hide away from that responsibility to do what's right. So that's sort of where we sit on that. But yes, of course, we have looked at it.
And the only other thing I just add is clearly anyone in the oil and gas space that we do bank will have to have Paris-aligned strategies as well, right? So.
Correct.
Thank you.
I mean, I don't mean to be, it's a debate we have here, and it's an interesting question, which is just, would you rather have a small exposure the customers who are not doing the right thing, or have a larger exposure, the customers who are. And, you know, we've said, hey, we're in that latter camp. Now, the onus is on us to make sure that that definition of doing the right thing is extremely robust, extremely high standard, and we have, you know, incredibly high degrees of confidence, going to one of the earlier questions, that people are serious about this and it really will have an impact on lower emissions, not just for our portfolio, but for the, you know, for the planet, not just for ANZ, so that we can turn up and say our, you know, our little portfolio looks a little bit better. So it's really about having a perspective on the bigger ambition here.
Yeah, and I understand, and point taken. It's sort of the similar debate around, you know, divestment versus engagement and working with customers.
Yes, good point. Doesn't make it easy, though. That's part of the problem. Unfortunately, it's much more complicated.
Well, it is, and that's why we tend to have very long discussions, one, about policy, and two, about transactions, but very importantly, about the customers we're banking in.
Yep.
Thank you. Your next question comes from David Whittaker from New South Wales Treasury Corporation. Please go ahead.
Hi, Shane, Mark and Jared. Thanks very much for the presentation and the increased disclosure. My question is a little bit similar to Amy's in that I'm just interested in how you think about this. There's a lot of your pathways are in terms of emissions carbon intensity. How do you think about absolute emissions at both the bank level and at the customer level?
Well, I'll start. And again, you've hit on a very complex area. So we could reduce absolute emissions by sort of, you know, exiting, reducing, running away from the sector, but actually have no impact and potentially a negative impact on the environment. And so the question is, we might feel good about that by avoiding that, but that clearly can't be the right answer. And so what we seek to do is, again, try to get that balance right, and it goes back to that, you know, essentially what we just talked about with Amy. How do we ensure that we use our resources, which we accept are vast, and our balance sheet and our capabilities, to actually drive lower emissions towards the Paris agreed goals. That may mean we end up increasing exposure, and it may mean that the emissions we count from our customers could actually go up. Now the question is, are we driving better outcomes for those customers because of our capabilities and making sure they do the right thing, as opposed to them going to other sources of capital, for example. And so that is a trade-off and part of the difficulty of choices we have to make.
Yeah, thanks. And so just to understand the focus on carbon intensity, If a customer buys another asset of a lower carbon intensity, thereby lowering its average carbon intensity, does that mean it passes your hurdle for funding?
So again, I'm glad we're having these questions because you guys are getting to the heart of why this is hard. So again, the easy answer to that is say yes. Haven't we done a good job? But the true answer is there's somewhere in the middle there.
Potentially.
So, yeah, potentially. I mean, again, it is a complex set of variables we need to look at and stand back from. And I don't think there are easy answers or easy indexes or mathematical solutions to these. It requires some of our judgment to really look and say, is this really achieving the outcomes that we aspire to?
Just to add to that, that point goes to the question that's been asked a number of times about, in effect, the credibility of the transition plans of our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And as Mark and Shane have both indicated a number of times, we examine them very, very carefully, not just simply for alignment with the letter of the policy, but also with the intent of the policy. So as Mark in particular has emphasised, the hurdle is very high.
So David, if we sort of when we sit down and with the example that you put forward, we would look at that, and if we felt that it was definitely reducing the emissions, but we were uncomfortable with the trajectory within that company overall, we would possibly say no to it. So we look at both. We look at, you know, what they've committed to 2025, how that fits within our own portfolio, whether we're comfortable with what they're doing will meet both their commitments and our commitments, and how confident we are that that will occur. And so that's why it's not easy. I can assure you the conversations that we have go for a long period of time as we look at each of these opportunities, and I think they'll probably get more intense as we go forward. But ultimately, it has to hit a number of hurdles before we would say yes to it.
And the other thing I would say is, you know, these are not foreign concepts to us. It's sort of how we run our own business. And I'm just looking at Kevin here, and I'm thinking about, we're very well aware of the denominator and numerator effects on lots of things we do in terms of risk, right? I mean, it is essentially, we know, for example, about things like even those exact same parallels in terms of how the impact it has on our margins, for example. I can increase my margins by just booking riskier loans. So we operate in a not a dissimilar space of having to trade off the absolutes and the relatives and all those things. So, you know, I'm not saying we're experts, but we certainly, it's not a foreign concept to us, and we get that.
Thank you. You've been very generous with your time. Just one more question. What's the role of offsets in your pathways and when you're looking at both the bank and at the customer level?
So in terms of our own emissions, you know, we've been using offsets for a number of years, but importantly what we're doing in terms of our own emissions, but I think importantly there we're moving to 100% renewable energy by 2025. We've made that commitment and we're well on the way to be able to do that. So they've had a role, if you will, in that transition for ourselves. I don't know, who wants to talk about from a customer perspective?
From a customer perspective, it's exactly the same principle. I mean, you know, there's a net zero 2050 target. And so the emphasis on net. But what we see with regards to offsets is it's part of a transition. So obviously we would like to see zero by 2050. I think everybody would agree to that. Whether that's achievable or not is sort of outside of my area of expertise. But what we do see is with our customers is that they will use some of the offsets for a period of time as they actually take the intensity of their own emissions, whichever industry they're in, down lower. And we like to see both.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you. Your next question comes from Carlos Castillo from Melior. Please go ahead.
Thanks for your time. I've just got a few questions. The first one, why do you think it's appropriate to wait up to 3 years till 2024 to set emission reduction targets for some of the other higher emitting segments of the loan book?
It's really to do with the quality of the data. I mean, this is not, you know, write a little program and, you know, hey presto, computer spits out the numbers, right? This is complicated, and we need to have a high degree of fidelity in the numbers. And you know, obviously as a bank we take numbers pretty seriously. So I'm not dismissing that, and obviously we want to go faster if we can, but we've tried to be realistic in terms of ambition. But not shying away from that, and if we can do faster we will.
Right, okay. To what extent is the remuneration for the executives within the bank going to be tied to the targets that are set here around the loan book?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, we're a complex organisation, so inevitably we have a complex set of objectives in terms of our balanced scorecard. There are public, the executives have a public scorecard in there, and then as we move down through Mark and his team in particular, I'm just using institutional as an example, you will see an increasing weighting and increasing evidence that these sorts of measures will be reflected in their goals and in their objectives.
So we've always had, Carlos, specific targets, objectives around risk management. We see this as an important element of that going forward, and it's getting increasing focus within the teams. One of the reasons that we're educating the team so strongly right as we speak is that we want them to understand the importance of what we're trying to do here, and it will be reflected in remuneration. So it's picked up in that whole risk management structure.
Okay, all right. And lastly, thank you. For the sectors where you have set targets like commercial property, power generation, to what extent is sort of the standardised sort of lending documentation for customers in those segments going to start to incorporate, say, for instance, covenants around their emissions levels?
That's a good question.
Yeah, et cetera.
Yeah, I understand. Kevin, do you want to talk about it?
Look, I think what's clearly happening in that space in particular is that the customers themselves understand the need to transition, and they're actually the ones who, in many cases, are also driving it. But have we sort of specifically in all of those cases set out covenants that say X, Y, and Z? That's not what we've got to yet, but our conversations with the customers have been around setting out what are our expectations of them to the things that we alluded to earlier in terms of very clear, specific, time-bound, public disclosures that they've got on this. So it's about ensuring that they comply with each of those key items that we've spoken about before.
Yeah, and I think we've already implemented some, there's a progression here. We've done that with regards to some of the policy settings that we have internally and what our expectations are with industries and customers around our policy settings. That's then the natural progression is probably to head the direction that you're sort of talking about there, Carlos. I would think that would naturally happen. But we already do that very specifically when it comes to sustainable linked loans or bonds. And where they're independently audited externally, and we're very, very cautious around who customers use and if we support. We won't support customers unless in that sort of area unless there is very clear guidelines that are independently reviewed and obligations that they have to meet that criteria, or else we won't support the transaction. So it's happened in that sort of bond area particularly. You know, as that manifests down into bank lending, I think that's probably a natural progression, but we're not there at this point.
So we have had some customers in the commercial property space, for example, where we have, to Mark's point, provided sustainability-linked loans to them, and then there's a series of metrics that they need to, we'll call them KPIs, for want of better words, that they need to meet. If they do, then there's pricing discounts or even premium triggers if they miss those targets as well.
Yeah, and Carlos, this, to my mind, is a really, really important area. You know, we need this to be robust across the industry and ensure that we're setting the right standards and holding parties accountable if they're meeting or missing what their commitments are.
Yep. No, that's good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Your final question comes from Sybil Dixon from UniSuper. Please go ahead.
Hello, and thank you again for your time today. I think one of the questions I have is around sort of the engagement with your higher emitting customers, but also sort of the supporting infrastructure and regions potentially that are quite exposed to these fossil fuel intensive or high emissions industries. How do you kind of, and a lot of what we're doing is sort of learning by doing, and there seems to be a lot of, there's quite a lot of rapid evolution in expectations, both from a banking perspective as an investor. How do you have those conversations with your customers around something might have been sort of okay and tick the box like 2 years ago, but now it's sort of on the edge of not really being appropriate and you can see where the direction of travel is going. How do you sort of breach some of those tensions? So like you have the IEA 1.5 degree scenario come out. How do you then sort of approach that with your customers around, you know, how things are moving and changing and shifting?
So I'll start and then Mark can talk in detail. It's a really good question. So the good news is that we are talking about 100 top emitting customers, so not, you know, not 1,000. And these 100 obviously have a very big material impact. The other good news is that for most of those 100, these are people we know well and we've been banking them for a long period of time. And we have
extremely high levels of engagement right from the top down. So in some cases that is including board members, certainly CEO and down, and so that engagement and discussion will be as simple in many cases as just with me having conversations with my peers and those customers, talking about how are they thinking this through, what are the conversations they're having with their board, what kind of frameworks do they put in place to think about the future, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that's probably less at the less formal end, but that really informs us about the culture of our customers and the way they think about ideas. And frankly, it's a great learning opportunity for us because, as Mark mentioned before, many in that 100 are actually further ahead on the thinking than we are and have actually quite well progressed, and so we get to learn. But then, obviously, we have a multi-tiered set of relationships right through. But, Mark, you can talk to a little bit more about how we engage right down through those organisations.
Yeah, there's a number of organisations because I think, Sybil, the other thing that you sort of alluded to, how quickly it's moving, but there's multiple numbers of stakeholders that we're having to talk to, not just the customers, but a whole range of other areas, people, investors, obviously industry bodies, et cetera, and local communities. And I might circle back to that point because I know you mentioned it. So we don't have one conversation. We're having many of them. And it's interesting because as we started this journey, we wondered how it would be received with the big companies. I think it's fair to say 2 years ago it was probably, I wouldn't say frosty, but it was more difficult conversations because we were learning, to your point, they were learning, and things were starting to move at pace. And so the conversations have become more frequent, and I think they've become more cooperative is the way I would look at it, because many of our customers are seeking to understand the issues that are most important in the industry and where we're seeing market best practice. We're able to circle some of that back to them around what we're seeing. And so it's a two-way conversation, whereas previously I think it was more of a one-way. But as Shane said, we do it at CEO, CFO, treasurer. Most of these larger companies have their own ES teams now. We work with them on that. We share what our policies are and what we're seeing in industry developments with them. They do the same back. So the conversations are ongoing and they're getting richer is the way I would define it. With the other stakeholders, and you mentioned local communities, now we operate, some communities will be affected by some of the movement on climate change, as we all well know, around jobs, etc. And what we've done, we've put in place, we operate in those communities, we bank in those communities, we have our staff that are part of those communities. We've been working closely with a number of these communities and the bodies in those communities to seek to understand through our staff what are the most important issues and how they're looking at transition and what they would like to see in regards to support. Now, we've been doing that now for a number of months. That information comes back up to us and it allows us then to think about policies associated and working with those communities around how they transition and how they could be the beneficiary of new roles and jobs that might be part of the transition. That's early work, but I think it could be really valuable work for us going forward.
Fantastic. Thanks very much. That's all from me.
Thank you. There are no further questions at this time. I'll now hand back to Mr. Elliott for closing remarks.
Okay. So look, thanks very much for the questions. Very thoughtful as we expected. And as you know, this is a progression and we're really pleased with the progress we're making on this, but there's obviously more work to be done and more opportunity ahead. I think the important message, as I mentioned here, we really do feel there's a pivot here for us as an organisation, partly because of the amount we've learned, but really moving away from purely a risk-based sort of what we won't do approach to really continuing that, but very much considering and looking at to the opportunity, because this transition requires banks and needs banks to enable the move to a low carbon future, and we believe ANZ is particularly well placed to be a leading player in that opportunity and to do so responsibly and ethically. So thanks very much for your questions, everybody, and I'm sure we'll have opportunity to talk about this further in the future. Thanks.
Thank you. That does conclude our conference for today. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.